deeper patches lie tucked along shaded corners of underbrush. He still has 20 miles of backcountry roads to cross. He makes 3 turns, driving carefully, meeting no one. Over the next 45 minutes, he cruises through thick woods. In places, on either side of the road, the high pine trunks stand like telephone poles. Sparse, leafless brush bedraggles the forest floor. The patches of snow worry him. "But I'm ready," he reminds himself, remembering the contents of his pack. He has plenty of warm wear. His sleeping bag is rated to 10 below. Jason knows it won't get that cold, but he is also concerned by the absence of recent tire tracks on the road's sand and gravel surface. Not many have driven this way, at least not since yesterday's light dousing. He makes his last turn. The road narrows and becomes much rougher than the back roads he's already driven over. He wonders if his Saturn can take it. He wends carefully over the ruts, dodging left and right to avoid potholes and soft spots, thankful the cold has been sufficient to freeze the ground. After almost an hour, he turns a corner and drives into the empty Isabella Lake parking area. The trailhead parking lot is a scruffy, wide spot to the side of the road. There is a sign for Isabella Lake, but there is nothing marking the start of the powwow. He examines the U.S. Forest Service sign, then looks along the edges of the parking lot. Isabella Lake is to the east. The powwow trail should cut off west of the lot. He walks over to get a better look and thinks he sees the start of a trail under the trees.
"Is that the powwow?" he wonders.
In the open lot, he squints in the light, feels warmed by the sun, though it's a cool 48 degrees. He appreciates the beautiful day. Yesterday had been overcast. The sky thickened and sleet fell in sharp gusts out of thick gray clouds, a harbinger of the coming cold. But for now the sky is clear, and the rising temperature is melting pockets of snow and ice. He returns to his Saturn, hoists his pack out of the back seat and steadies it on his car trunk. He holds one strap while he turns around and inserts first his right arm, then his left. He bends forward and feels his shoulders pull against the weight. Not bad. But he feels certain he could hike much farther than the 5 or 6 miles he needs to cover this afternoon. He lifts the bottom of the pack, adjusting it until it's balanced and comfortable. Then he cinches the hip belt, lifting it slightly so it rides on the fleshy muscle above his glutes. His is the only car in the lot. He's surprised. But it is Monday, he recollects. Late October. And he remembers wanting it this way, just him in the quiet woods. The entire trail to himself. He locks his car, pockets the keys, and walks across the lot to where he thinks the trailhead ought to be. He moves into the brush, searching for a path. For several minutes he explores the western edge of the lot boundary, crisscrossing into the woods. Finally, several yards in, he stumbles across a small path that widens ahead. He peers up the narrow trail, decides it must be the powwow, and turns onto it. 50 yards ahead, the trail becomes surprisingly spacious. His first half mile is as clear as an old logging road, and it looks like it's going to hold. During the 1960s, Tomahawk Lumber Company logged some of the land around Isabella Lake, including this stretch of the trail. The second stage forest is thick with alder, black spruce, tamarack, and birch. Jason's pack feels good in the early afternoon sun. The wind is low and the temperature perfect. He is entirely alone. He sees no one. There are no recent footprints. And it feels wonderful to stretch his legs in the afternoon warmth, to hear an occasional bird chirrup and hawk cry. A couple of ravens pass overhead, one of them making a sharp caw. He stops and watches them pass. It is quiet enough to hear the sound their wings make as they beat the air. A mile up the trail, a narrow footbridge crosses the stream that empties out of Isabella Lake. His map shows a small picnic area to the left, but he cannot see it. The sound of water falling away from the lake reaches his ears. A huge boulder in the middle of the cascade reminds Jason of REI's fake waterfall. While it is architecturally tasteful, it's no match for the real thing. He looks for a fish in the part of the stream flowing under the footbridge. but can only see the dark, tamarack-stained water running over black rocks. He revels at the heavy pull of pack straps against his shoulders, how it makes him feel clear and independent. This is exactly what he wanted. Yesterday's sleet and the ensuing thaw fill the air with the smell of humus. The trail is spectacularly vibrant. Jason pauses to fish his disposable camera from one of the zipper pockets of his North Face jacket. He looks up the stream toward Isabella Lake. There is a faint haze near the lake. He snaps a photo of the stream falling away from the big water, threading toward him. Then he keeps hiking, looking for the right place to take a trail shot in a long, clear path. Finally, he sees it and stops. The leaf-strewn trail runs out in front of him, narrowing in the distance into a brush wall, or maybe it's a turn. In the left foreground, there's a small balsam fir. Further down, there are some popples and a couple of tall, moth-eaten birch. Also on the left, a white pine rises out of the trees, and further on sits a wall of balsam fir mixed with thick young alder. On either side, the first tier forest growth forms an impenetrable wall. The brush is so thick, if a school bus were parked 10 feet into it, you wouldn't even know it was there. He pauses and snaps the picture. The trail is clear ahead, carpeted by a thick shuffle of leaves stretching toward an opaque dome. For most of the 2.6-mile start of the powwow, the path's openness holds. It is so clear, in fact, Jason doesn't refer to Pakite's trail description, his compass, or his more detailed fisher map. The hazy sky shows no sign of storm. The weather is exactly what he had hoped for. Cool walking in quiet woods, but warm enough to require only his light sweater. Parts of the trail are wet. Some areas are a little boggy, and he is careful to step on the high points, keeping his feet dry. Otherwise, the way is clear, and after just an hour and a half hiking, he crosses over a large marshy area. There is water to his right, backed up by an enormous old beaver dam. He crosses on what must be the top of the dam, then enters into a stand of jack pine. On one of the largest trees is a familiar wooden marker. It isn't much. A dark brown, 6-inch diamond of wood with clear yellow arrows pointing in opposite directions. He is at the powwow circuit juncture. To the left, the arrow points clockwise, wending in a west-northwesterly direction. To the right, the trail is just as clear, but strikes off in a more northerly direction. He turns right, hiking north-northeast, and immediately the trail narrows to a thin footpath. He walks on a damp, moss-covered path through the trees. It is cool in the shade of the trees. After a quarter mile, he is glad to notice an opening ahead. But as he approaches it, he sees it as a long beaver dam, its outer edge built directly over his path. He skirts its backside. There's plenty of seepage beneath a thick mesh of remarkable engineering, but enough high spots to enable him to keep his feet dry if he moves carefully. He pauses at the dam's apex, looking out over the still, clear water. An assortment of leaves litter the pond's surface. Its bottom is a mosaic of fall color. The dam itself is so long and thick, its backside laid out in a gentle slope of branches and sticks, some of them over 2 inches in diameter. He wonders how many beavers there are. He scans the surface of the pond and sees, tucked back into a far corner, a beaver lodge grown over a bank. He watches for a while. Water seeps from beneath the massive dam, trickling in hundreds of narrow rivulets on its course through the woods. He is surrounded by the music of water. He pulls his camera out of the pack's side pocket and snaps another picture. Over the next hour, Jason traverses 3 more beaver dams. The whole area is marshy and wet, and though he has tried to keep his feet dry, he can feel his right foot damp along the boggy trail. He hikes carefully, pleased by this minor trail obstacle, something unexpected and interesting. When he passes another dam, the path widens. He pauses, looks up. An unexpected thickness to the sky has come in from the west. The day is still mild, warm by late October standards, but the bright glint has faded to a flat, metallic hue. Jason still has no reason to consult his map, compass, or hiking Minnesota's description of the trail. His path is clear. The day feels good. The walking is relatively easy. After more than 2 hours of hiking, he crosses the last beaver dam and continues along the path, which is narrow but still clear. In fact, the part of the trail that hooks up with the old powwow, the eastern branch abandoned years ago, is clear and straight in front of him. The place where Jason is supposed to turn is covered over with weeds. But Jason recollects from his earlier map reads that it is just about time for his 90-degree turn to the northwest, toward Poe's Lake, and there is a faint opening to his left. He studies it, but when he compares the gnarled, grass-covered rise to the broad opening in front of him, he is uncertain which path to follow. In the days when lumber companies foraged trees through this part of the boundary waters, before it was the BWCAW, small logging camps were set up at key points in the forest. The open, straight path in front of Jason is the old trail to Calamity Lake Camp, over 2 miles further east. After the camp was dismantled, the trail served as the northern loop of the old powwow, before beavers had their way. Over the years, enough men, horses, logs, and hikers traveled over the spot to make it easily discernible through the trees. Truth is, the entire area is crisscrossed by old trails. But Jason knows nothing of old logging camps or abandoned hiking paths, and there are no clear markings on any of his maps, not at least the ones he carries with him. Finally, he decides to turn left, continuing along the new powwow until he feels certain he has made the right choice. But he is somewhat puzzled by the straight, clear path from which he veered, which was too big to be a game trail. Still, the afternoon is quiet and haunting, and he quickly settles back to enjoy the scenery, the hike, and the rare luxury of abandoning himself to his own random thoughts. Jason hikes for another hour, lost in the beauty of the afternoon, traversing some messy low spots as he walks. He passes a few more old beaver haunts. Beavers can significantly alter landscapes within a matter of 2 to 3 years. He assumes, judging from the poor state of the trail, they've been at work here. He keeps walking in a straight northwesterly line, happy to be in the woods, oblivious to the passage of time. He reaches another key point in the trail where it bends left, not quite in a 90-degree angle, but significant enough to be noticeable, at least on the map. But he is not looking at the map. Because this turn in the trail is especially difficult to find, someone once built a stone cairn at the spot. Over the years, wild growth covered the cairn, like everything else in the area, and now it appears to be nothing more than a glacial pile of stone. In fact, the turn onto the new western proper powwow is little more than a narrow gap in the forest tangle, easily disregarded. A hiker would have to be searching for the turn, knowing when to expect it. Jason is enjoying his afternoon, lost in his thoughts. Since he's not anticipating the radical shift in direction, he keeps to the obvious path that lies before him, still wide and clear. There was a time this was a main trail, the old portage trail to Insula Lake, and part of an old logging road. A mile ahead it links up with another old logging road, angling east into another old timber camp. That was 50 years ago. The wide path before him is the only trace of the camp or the acres of harvested timber. For now, it is the clear choice. Unaware that he has missed his turn, and is gradually hiking deeper into impenetrable brush, dangerous bogs, and a landscape beavers have had decades to transform, Jason continues walking.
4. Lost. Bell Lake, Quetico Provincial Park, Wednesday afternoon, August 5, 1998.
Jerry Wills sits in the middle of his canoe and studies the map. He sees where Dan headed into the trees, but as he hovers in the water he thinks Dan's point of departure is off by about 50 yards. Further down the shore there's a huge cedar twisted out over the lake's surface. It obscures the shoreline behind it. He and his scouts paddle down around the tree, and they find what appears to be the start of a portage trail. Wills remembers the ranger's warning, and he won't bushwhack a portage if it isn't apparent. But this definitely looks like the start of something. He and the scouts get out of their canoe and examine the path. It appears flat and wide enough to be the portage. They beach their canoe and hike in to have a better look. After 40 yards, Bell Lake's blue waters come into view.
"Let's go back and tell 'em," he says, triumph in his voice.
The three of them return to their beached canoe and hoist the heavy Duluth packs out of its hold. From around the side of the overhanging tree, the prow of the 17-year-old's canoe spikes into view. Matt and Jake Spann have paddled down, searching for Mr. Wills. From up on the bank, Jerry smiles down at them.
"The portage is over here," he says, pointing toward the start of the path.
"We can't find Dan," Matt says.
There is concern in the young scout's face.
"Where did he go?"
Wills asks.
"Into the woods up the shoreline, looking for the trail. But he hasn't come back."
"And it's been a while," Jake adds.
He looks down at his watch.
"Almost half an hour. Mr. Jones wanted us to find you."
It was not uncommon for Dan to scout the trail. He needed to find it and then be sure there were no fallen logs or places where the path petered out or disappeared. But he'd never been gone more than 10 minutes, and this portage was a short one. From up the shoreline, Wills hears Tim Jones and David shout Dan's name. He tells the others to unload the canoe. Matt and Jake get out, haul their aluminum craft up onto the narrow passage opening, and start to unload. After the packs are out of Will's canoe, he and Justin paddle back to the shadowy bank of cedars. Tim Jones is happy for the parental reinforcement.
"I guess he's still looking," he observes.
Tim is concerned, but at this point he expects Dan's momentary return, or at least to hear his answer through the woods. Finally, one of the scouts finds his whistle, raises it, and blows. 3 long, piercing signals cut through the afternoon air. They all pause, waiting for a response. But there is only silence and the interminable insect whine. It is as though the canopy of dark boughs has opened, swallowed their guide, and then closed up behind him.
"The portage is down the shoreline, behind that tree," Wills points.
"I heard," Tim answers.
"Why don't you take my canoe and get the rest of the crew over into Bell? I'll stay here with Justin, and we'll wait for Dan on this end."
Tim is more than happy to leave the ominous swamp. In spite of his repellent, he is waving away bugs. It takes them less than a minute to get into the canoe and start off down the shoreline. Once at the portage, they unload their gear and ferry it across. By now they are an experienced team. They cross the narrow spit of land in fewer than 15 minutes. On the way over the portage, there is no sign of Dan. At the other side, staring out over Bell Lake, they peer down the shoreline in both directions, looking for any movement through the brush, listening. There is nothing. They wait at the edge of Bell, trying to stay clear of the bugs. In spite of Dan's bizarre disappearance, they are still enjoying the beauty of the day. Some of the scouts pass time by casting lures into the blue waters. They are certain at any moment Dan will come traipsing over the portage, and they will scoot on to Bell and find somewhere to lunch. But after almost an hour, there was no word from the other side, and still no sign of Dan. Tim sends Matt back across the portage to find out what's keeping the others. In 15 minutes, Matt returns and says Dan still hasn't shown up, but they will wait a little longer, that Mr. Wills says they should hold tight. Tim sighs, annoyed by the temporary inconvenience. He still feels certain Dan is finding his way through the woods, and it will only be a matter of time before he appears on Bell's thickly wooded shoreline, somewhere down along south of them, he guesses. He and his son Sean get into a canoe and paddle along Bell's southern shoreline. They whistle and call, hoping Dan will hear them. They skirt the shoreline 100 yards before turning and starting back. For the first hour, Jerry Wills and Justin waited near the edge of the trees, occasionally calling, trying to rest in the midday sun. After a while, they decide to explore the dark grove of cedars, bend into the narrow shadows, yelling Dan's name. But there is nothing. A little later, they push 20 yards into the cedars, well out of view of the shoreline. But the air is thick and heavy, and in seconds they are surrounded by a pestilential storm. That, and the unusual darkness of the swamp, drives them back to the lake. They continue calling.
For more than an hour they stay near the shore, their shouts and whistle blows periodically breaking the afternoon's light breeze. But there is no sign of Dan Stevens. No answer. He has walked into the woods and disappeared. Matt returns from over the portage, and now the two young scouts suggest they hike in farther. But Jerry Wills reasons that if their inimitable Georgian guide walked just 1 minute into those woods and got lost, or worse, attacked by a bear, cougar, or wolves, their own chances of survival are slim. In the end, he decides to venture in far enough to retrieve Dan's canoe. He pushes in a wide semicircle, branching out from the point of Dan's departure, making a deeper and deeper sweep through the trees. He calls back to Matt and Justin near the shoreline, making sure he remains within earshot, careful to keep that connection between them. First, his circle arches 10 yards, then he doubles back deeper. Finally, about 40 yards into the woods, he sees the pointed stern of Dan's canoe hanging out of cedar boughs like a shining silver star. Finding Dan's canoe heartens Jerry. Dan's gear tub rests on the ground beneath his canoe. It is a plastic tub in which Dan keeps his food, clothes, down bag, journal, everything but the tent, which is shared with others in the group. Jerry Wills calls out for Dan, but again there is no response. The bugs are swarming. He looks up at the canoe and knows he is going to need help getting it down. He calls to the tallest scout to follow his voice in, and together they pull the canoe out of the branches, gather Dan's plastic gear tub, and return to the shoreline. "He's got to be near Bell," Jerry thinks out loud. It is a sentiment the others share. They decide to paddle to the portage and cross over. About the time Jerry and his two scouts come over the portage, Tim and Sean are returning from their fourth paddle down the Bell Lake shoreline. There has been no sign of Dan. There is a touch of worry, maybe even apprehension, in the quiet way Mr. Wills and Mr. Jones bend over the map. They note where Dan went into the woods. It is an area where the two shorelines curve away from each other. Due south of his entry point, there is nothing but woods and marsh. But they know Dan Stevens wouldn't hike south. If he did, losing the sun and the understory, he could easily correct his direction as soon as he found some open space among the trees. But even if Dan took a rounded course through the trees, he should have appeared somewhere along the Bell Lake shoreline. By now the afternoon is getting on. The two fathers peer at the map, trying to figure out their next move. The unwritten rule in the Kateko is to locate and claim a campsite by 4 p.m. It is not always observed, but under the circumstances, both fathers believe their troop could use a break. They still haven't eaten, and it's late enough to settle down for the day, find some place close where they can keep an eye out for Dan, when he finally comes crashing through those trees. Then, if they have to return and continue searching, there will still be plenty of daylight. They peer at the map. Bell is a beautiful, long, clear stretch of water. Solid red dots indicate campsites. According to the map, midway down Bell's northwestern shoreline, there should be a space among the trees. They are not quite at a vantage point where they can see it, but it should be a relatively short paddle. The fathers decide to ferry their scouts and supplies to the mid-lake site, set up camp, have an early dinner. Everyone is starving. And if Dan still hasn't appeared, Jerry and a couple of the other scouts will return and look for him. They are all still certain of Dan's eventual reappearance. For now, it is a momentary glitch in an otherwise remarkable trip. But as the scouts and fathers cross Bell Lake in the afternoon sun, they wonder what happened to their guide.
Bushwhacking.
Thought can also intrude when you're walking in the woods. Say you're walking through a tamarack bog, sphagnum moss at your feet, a trail cutting through it. You're hiking through this forest at a leisurely pace, but 10 or 15 minutes later you realize that the forest has changed. Now you're in an upland forest of ash, oak, and hickory. You look back down the trail. You don't see any conifers. You didn't notice the change. You realize you were talking to yourself about something, thinking about something. And you can't remember what it was you were talking or thinking about. Paul Resendez, The Wild Within, Adventures in Nature and Animal Teachings. 5. First Camp. The Trail Toward Lake Insula, BWCAW, Late Afternoon, October 22,
2001.
For the next hour, Jason Rasmussen hikes the old trail moving north toward Lake Insula. The sky has turned overcast. He still has plenty of light, but the sun is hidden beneath cloud cover. He walks almost due north, believing he's heading to the northwest, about to encounter the Pose Lake Spur and its campsite. Around 5 o'clock, he starts searching for the site. The path narrows to an overgrown game trail, sometimes indiscernible through the trees. After a few paces, it reappears, and he keeps to it, searching for the spur. Finally tired, ready to set up camp, Jason decides he's close enough and starts searching for the first suitable place to pitch his tent. To the side of the overgrown trail, he notices a small opening in the trees, with an old fire ring beside it. A few paces ahead, the site runs down into a narrow bog. He sees patches of water along the bog's surface, some of it creek-like, though it appears still in the dusk. According to the Hiking Minnesota map, the campsite should be overlooking Pose Lake. Clearly, this isn't a lake. Actually, it is Amu Creek. At this juncture, the creek is a faint seepage through a low spit of land. Further upstream, it is wide and clear, a geographic anomaly that might convince you to take a second, closer look at your map. But here, it doesn't look to be much more than the back reaches of another dammed-up beaver pond. And Jason is weary. Thankful for the old campsite, which indicates he is still on the trail, he sets down his pack. His back feels sore, but good. Where the padded straps rode across his shoulders, he feels a pleasant muscular tension. Relieved of the heavy pack, he suddenly feels light, with more than enough energy to set up camp. He finds a wide, flat space just big enough for his tent. He crosses it, checking for low spots, root spurs, or rocks. He finds a couple of small, knobby rocks and kicks them aside, smoothing the ground in preparation for his tent. Then he unpacks, spreads the tent across the groomed surface, extends and inserts the interlocking poles. It feels good to be setting up camp. He marvels at his shelter's simple design. There are no difficult stakes, no directions to pore over. There are only so many ways you can extend and insert the poles. He settles the bright orange tent fly over the top of the tent, fastening its edges to the main poles. Throughout the afternoon, the sky has thickened, and now there's a chance of rain. He is glad to have the fly, something that will keep him dry and warm. As he steps away, the tent looks taut and open. He has to tie out its sides with some green and red nylon twine. Now it looks ready for habitation. Jason forages the nearby woods for firewood. He has brought a small portable saw he uses to size down good chunks of dead wood. It takes less than 20 minutes to stack a reasonable pile of seasoned kindling near the old fire pit. It is starting to get dark. Jason returns to his pack. He's hungry. He extracts the whisper-like cook stove and one bottle of white gas. He should have plenty of stove gas for his brief 3 nights in the woods, but he still wants to be careful in its use. He unpacks everything and sets up his camp pot with water, so once the stove flame is lit, he can balance it on the delicate tripod. He finds a perfect flat stone on which to place the stove. Then he pumps the gas bottle, letting a little gas out into the collection ring beneath the burner. He builds up pressure before he lights it. There is a whoosh as the highly combustible gas ignites and burns. He turns the release valve, letting out the pressurized gas until he hears the blue flame hiss and take hold. While his water heats, he gathers dead grass and leaves from the edge of his campsite. He places them in the bottom of his fire pit. Then he lays small twigs and branches on top, leaving plenty of air to let the fire breathe. It takes only one click of his parents' charcoal lighter. When the flame is thick and rising, he lays on larger sticks. The fire is warm in the gloaming. It brings a satisfying, crackly light to the end of the day. He feeds the yellow flame with larger pieces of wood. The sky darkens. Since it is overcast, it is difficult to pinpoint the exact location of the setting sun. Besides, Jason is too busy over his stove. He waits until the water starts to bubble, then pours in the freeze-dried sweet and sour chicken, one of his favorites. He waits, watching it steam and bubble, stirring the glutinous mass with his fork. His smell is intoxicating. He stirs and lifts the fork out, careful to bring up some of the mixture on his tines, watching it steam. He blows on it, but cannot help himself.
Before it is completely cooled, he sticks the hot fork into his mouth.
"Christ," he says,
his tongue stinging from the heat.
"Jesus Christ."
But the tang of the sauce and the bit of not completely hydrated chicken tastes better than he expected. His mouth waters. After dinner and cleanup, he adds more logs to his fire. Then he hoists his supplies over a nearby tree branch, well off the ground and out of reach of whatever critters might happen upon them. Probably raccoon this time of year. But he guesses bears might still be roaming the fall woods. Bears would be attracted to the aroma of sweet and sour chicken. Then he recalls the patches of snow on the ground. He cannot remember, but he thinks he has read somewhere that bears are usually in their dens by late October. Anyway, he is willing to tell himself the recollection is fact. He will sleep better tonight, and he's tired. He tries to remember a time he has felt so satisfied. He recalls a line from a Robert Frost poem. "These woods are lovely, dark and deep." He tries to resurrect the rest of the poem, but can only recall fragments. "To stop without a farmhouse near, the darkest evening of the year." And then he recalls the last two lines. "And miles to go before I sleep. And miles to go before I sleep." He looks around. It is almost dark. He feeds the rest of his pile of logs into the fire and watches as they catch and burn, sending the blaze higher. He stares at his watch, barely able to read its face in the firelight. He reaches up, pressing its indiglo button, and the watch face comes alive. It is almost 8 p.m. He cannot remember being this tired. He knows he is going to sleep well. He notices a slight breeze high up in the branches. He wonders if it presages rain. Otherwise, he is completely without worry, happy to be here, warmed by his fire, just about ready to turn in. Finally, he stands up and walks over to the edge of the brush. He pees on the lower boughs of a young black spruce. The acrid odor of the urine-drenched tree drifts up, wafts away from his tent. Within 15 minutes, he is tucked into the warm cocoon of his down bag. It is cold at first. Now his body warms its new environs. He marvels at the beauty of deep woods. Outside, the fire has reached its peak and is starting to diminish. The shadows still dance along the nearer trees and against the green tent opening. So far, it has been a wonderful journey. He was not able to find the Pose Lake Spur and the campsite overlooking the lake, but it must be very close. He suspects he may have passed the spur, continuing to hike west. He is surprised by how thin and barely discernible parts of the trail have been, and there are no markings. He has more than enough food. He could live like this for well over a week and not lose a pound. He is warm and dry and feels secure in the profound quiet, the only sound the slow hiss and crackle of burning wood. He listens, trying to hear something else. The wind soughs through the branches. He wonders if others who have come this way have felt this good. It's the woods. He smiles, recalling Thoreau's epigraph. It's the tonic of the wilderness. Of course they felt good. He is very tired. His lids are closing and he is nearly asleep. Who could have walked through such a day, through these woods, and not felt this good? Then he falls asleep. 6. The Scream. Bell Lake Environs, Katiko Provincial Park, Wednesday evening, August 5, 1998. Dan Stevens's eyes flicker. His head throbs, but a wave of nausea sends him back to unconsciousness. He reawakens, tries to sit up. For several minutes, the pain forces him prone. He is jammed into a low wedge of rocks. When he opens his eyes, he sees a huge boulder towering over him. The sky is clear. He is disoriented, but guesses it is mid-afternoon. After several minutes, he manages to sit upright. A second wave of nausea sweeps over his stomach and chest. He rests on his elbow, waiting for the sickness to subside. His head throbs. There is a dull ringing in his ears. Everything sounds muted and muffled. When he touches his head, he feels a lump the size of a loon's egg. He must have fallen and struck the rock. He's uncertain of his whereabouts. He recalls his Tennessee friends, but he is unclear about his location, where they are, where he was headed, or what happened.
From under a thick fog, reason struggles to reassert itself. He calls, but the meager vocalization only intensifies his head throbbing. And there is no response. Dan struggles out of his low clutch of rocks. He leans against a large boulder, uncertain and disoriented, trying to get a hold of himself. Even if he was clear about the purpose of his search, its timing and direction, a return to the shoreline would reveal nothing but tracks. His troop was over a mile away, searching for the campsite on Bell Lake. But he is far from lucid, and his perspective is muddled. When his head pain subsides, he remembers the cloverleaf pattern he uses to locate portage trails. He is thinking clearly enough to recall a simple modification. He can launch out and make a large wheel pattern through the trees, look for his friends. He will walk straight in one direction for a minute. He has his watch. He will find a marker and then walk out from that position until he recovers his friends and their supplies, or stumbles across a familiar trail or lake. He feels lightheaded, almost drunk. But there is none of the pleasant feeling of inebriation. Instead, he feels temporary fits of clarity bounded by long lapses in judgment. He has persistent nausea and a jackhammer head. He starts pushing through the trees. The trees give way to low brush and boggy marsh. He stumbles through the marsh, recovering his legs, and manages a relatively straight path for almost 15 seconds. Unfortunately, he moves away from the lake, almost due south, deeper into the brush, in the exact opposite direction from No Name Lake, its shoreline, and his Chattanooga friends. He tries to stay focused, but his peripheral vision picks up a spot of yellow in a patch of sunlight. He is drawn to its vibrant color. It is a wild black-eyed Susan, unusual for these woods. He leans over to consider it. He is struck by its symmetry and design. He pauses, kneels to take a closer look. It might be good to rest a minute. He feels dizzy, his stomach roiling. Even through his head pain, he admires the flower. He has no sense of the passage of time. He stares at the flower, bending in the light. After a while, he looks at his watch, and it appears to have moved forward half an hour. He gets up, keeps walking. He returns to the wheel pattern, recalling its clarity and brilliance, remembering his purpose, and strikes off through more swamp. A half hour later, he finds himself in the middle of thick brush. He makes a wide turn in the brush, looking out at a nearby thicket. Along the edge of the thicket, water seeps down a shallow, swampy ravine. Dan turns along the seepage, trying to avoid the deeper pockets of muck. He angles in the general direction he was headed, but still wonders about his position. He moves ahead, toward an area of lowland brush that looks like it might open, possibly onto a lake. But when he reaches the opening, he sees an old beaver pond, largely filled in but still covered by a few inches of water. He looks out over its edge and pans the horizon from left to right. Left, there are more swampy, abandoned beaver ponds. To his right, the walking appears slightly easier, with ground that rises high enough to promise firmness. Beyond it, he sees what he thinks may be the edge of another lake. It is a long walk, but he starts forward, waving away bugs and lurching across the swamp bog complex. After another 30 minutes, maybe more, Dan comes to the edge of a U-shaped lake. The lake is small and will be easy to skirt, providing he has an idea of which way to turn, and in what direction he should head once he rounds it. He knows he is lost, but still feels confused. He tries to recollect his friends, wondering where they can be. "Hey!" he yells over the water. His voice sounds feeble in the warm afternoon. The weak vocalization makes his head throb. Still, maybe if he yelled louder. "Hey!" he repeats, this time nearly as loud as he can manage until the energy out of his throat moves across his head like a jackhammer. The blow almost brings him to his knees. He reaches up to rub his swollen knot. The large contusion is sore and painful, and he knows he has to sit down. He rests for a minute. Around the far shore, he finds an open stretch of rock reaching down into the lake. At the base of the rock is a huge white pine arching up and over the water. He reaches the escarpment and sits in the shade, trying to calm himself, trying to figure his coordinates, trying to reassert some clear idea of his friends and their location. He sits for a while,
staring out over the water, before finally realizing he needs a better view. Perhaps if he gets higher? He considers the tree behind him. In spite of his mental fuzziness and the dull throb of his head, he feels physically capable. In less than 15 minutes, he is 50 feet off the ground, peering out over the massive complex he has spent so much of the day hiking into. He discerns what he thinks is the man chain, or at least one of them. It looks like other man. He is comforted to find something he remembers, something familiar. He sees that if he strikes off in the direction of other man, he will have to skirt one small lake before reaching its distant shore. But he knows other man is a familiar paddle, a place where he might find his group or some other group canoeing down the chain. Over an hour later, he is still stumbling through thickets, realizing he has not yet encountered the small lake separating himself from other men. He thinks he should have found it by now. He wonders if his sense of distance went awry with everything else in this day. Dan finds another boggy beaver pond with another large white pine rising above it. He scales the pine and peers in all directions until he discovers other men behind him, not closer, but farther away. He realizes he must have gotten turned around in the bush and hiked away from the lake. He is stunned. He cannot believe he became that disoriented. For the first time, he feels scared. He descends the tree, realizing that unless he figures out a clear plan, or at the very least a straight direction, he could be walking in massive circles until dark. The thought of walking in darkness unnerves him, and he comes down to sit beside the beaver pond and contemplate his next move. Along the northwestern side of Bell Lake, the Chattanooga scouts find a campsite and unpack in worried silence. They fix themselves an early dinner, and then Jerry Wills takes two of his ablest scouts and heads back over the portage to No Name Lake. The cave-like gap in trees is exactly as it appeared before, but after swallowing their guide it has a new, ominous quality. The three get out of the canoe, and Wills starts bushwhacking long semicircles into the perimeter of trees. The apex of the semicircle is the exact location of Dan's departure. The three of them call out for Dan, but there is still no sign or response. Wills comes back, increases his semicircle by another 30 feet. They call and whistle. Wills pushes deeper into the woods, but it is dark and the mosquitoes hound him, and he cannot get the ranger's words out of his head. He knows that if he ventures too far in and gets lost or attacked, it would only compound their predicament. Like Tim Jones, Jerry recalls their collective prayer prior to leaving Chattanooga. In that prayer, they pledged to stay together. They asked God to watch over them. They told the parents their children would be safe, that there was nothing to worry about. They gave their word. Even now, Jerry Wills believes they will hike back over the portage and Dan will be waiting for them, or already back at camp. Wills is working on the close conversation he is going to have with their guide. Dan shouldn't have bushwhacked. He should not have gone into the woods without them. He should never have walked off alone and left them in the middle of wilderness they know nothing about, with only a vague sense of the trail before them, and no clear direction about what to do. He knows Dan Stevens didn't plan to get lost or worse, but Jerry Wills's worry is starting to rise, and he cannot help but imagine the words he and their guide are going to exchange. They return to their canoe, hoping to find him, but there is still no sign of Dan. Maybe back at camp, they think. The late afternoon light is slanting into early evening. Jerry Wills and his two companions paddle back to camp and are shocked to discover there has been no sign of Dan. The others at camp are equally shocked. Everyone is getting tired, and Jerry knows Dan's absence is taking its toll on the group's morale. Finally, the two fathers rummage for their FM radio phone. The Summers Canoe Base sends one out with every group. The phone is a bulky, crude device, powered by 6 D-cell batteries enclosed in a 12-inch length of PVC pipe. At one end, homemade wiring connects to the transmission device. If the phone gets damp or is jostled, both common occurrences on canoe trips, the connections can corrode or pull apart. And unless you were paying attention when Dan Stevens demonstrated how to use the device, operating it is not an easy thing to figure out. And there are rules about its use. It is only for emergencies, and since it is battery-powered, the calls must be brief.
There is no way for the men to know that in Dan Stevens' entire summer of guiding he never once had reason to take the phone out of its bag. It was periodically tested back at base camp, but the phone has never been field-tested. The assemblage is in the bottom of a pack and damp from riding low. When they switch it on, the red button light glows, but there's only a faint white noise coming from its receiver. When they press down to call, they assume their voices are being carried over the airwaves. But there is no response. Even if they knew where to look, there is no way for them to tell that the slim antenna near the top of the device is broken. It could have been the result of normal wear or of being jostled. Maybe a previous user sat on it and bent it back, separating the connection from its base. Maybe it had a faulty antenna from the moment the device was assembled. When the radio phone was tested near the canoe base, the problem didn't surface. Reception at that proximity did not require the antenna, and the phone worked fine. Now all they hear is faint white noise, not even sputtering static. Otherwise, the phone appears operational.
"Turn it off," Tim Jones finally says. "We'd best save those batteries."
"I think we need to get closer to base camp," Jerry Will suggests.
They are 35 miles north of base camp. Their situation is tenable at best, grim at worst. On the positive side, they have the maps, compasses, Dan's shared foreknowledge about where they were headed and how he planned to get them there. And they have plenty of food and gear. On the negative side, they are alone in wilderness they saw for the first time just 3 days earlier. And they have 6 teenagers, 2 of them young. Above all else, Jerry Wills and Tim Jones know they will do whatever it takes to keep these kids safe. Their Chattanooga community isn't large. They know these boys' families. These boys in this group are among the best Wills has ever accompanied. And it is a good thing, given their current situation. The two leaders don't voice their concern, but each of them is beginning to mull their options. Those of their troop who consider their guide's whereabouts worry about the slim Georgian and his engaging smile. It is too soon for any of them to contemplate complete tragedy. But already shadows dog their thoughts. What happened to him?
What if he never comes out of those woods?
What if they never see Dan Stevens again? Jerry Wills has not voiced this suspicion, but he wonders if Dan encountered a bear. Maybe a mother bear with cubs. Jerry knows that stepping between a mother and her cubs is a dangerous proposition. The two fathers, now absolute and unexpected leaders of their group, wander to the side of camp to talk about their options. Neither of them has paid attention to his mounting anxieties, or to the group's increasing, almost palpable, fretfulness. Until now, Jerry Wills has been occupied with his efforts back at the edge of the cedar swamp. Tim Jones has been busy establishing camp. He and Sean spent much of the early evening paddling Bell's southern shoreline, hoping their guide would break through the trees and they could pick him up and paddle triumphantly back to camp. And then they had been busy trying to make the phone operational, hoping for some kind of guidance from base camp, but nothing. Now they are alone, trying to make a viable plan, knowing these kids and their families depend on them. Truth is, it's a little too much responsibility and surprise. Not that the two men are unequal to the task, but they are in unfamiliar country, a long ways from home, and it is all a little unexpected. When Dan walked into the woods, they were certain he'd return. When he didn't return right away, they were sure it would only be minutes, then maybe an hour, then possibly longer. But he would return. They could always make camp and wait for him. They had plenty of supplies. And there was the radio phone. At every point in the day, they had another place to turn, another option ahead of them, another cause for hope. But Dan never appeared, and the radio phone wasn't operational, and now there is every reason to expect they are going to spend this night alone. As the day ended, the two men have few places to go for solace. In the growing dark near the edge of camp, the pressure boils over. Jerry Wills thinks that in the morning Tim should take Justin White, their strongest paddler, and paddle back over No Name, Fran, and the other portages they've crossed, climb the Silver Falls portage, and return to the Cache Bay Ranger Station for help. For Tim Jones, the thought of returning over those portages he is not even certain he can find, and then scaling Silver Falls while carrying his canoe, is a little too much to imagine. and he is worried about Jerry Wills. While Jerry has held his own, the strain is showing. His face is drawn and pinched, and his periods of rest are becoming more frequent and longer. Tim Jones hasn't expressed it, because until now it has not been an issue. But Jones has wondered why Jerry Wills came on such an arduous journey. Clearly, he was not in the best shape for it. Now the thought of separating the crew, leaving the kids, including his own son, with the strained Jerry Wills for 2 days, is an option he refuses to consider. For a moment, before the two men realize the stress and anxiety that has crept up on them, a sharp flare of words threatens to ignite into something more troubling. Eventually, they grow silent, each stung. They turn away into the waning daylight and gradually come to consider each other's perspectives, knowing that nothing will be served by either of them losing themselves in darkness. Finally, Jerry Wills sees the sense of Tim Jones's perspective, and Jones understands Wills's concern. It doesn't take much persuasion to convince Wills their troop won't be well served by separating. They have to get closer to base camp. Tomorrow morning they will break camp at dawn and continue along the man chain, paddling for help. They don't believe they can help Dan by going in after him, and they worry about getting lost, or something worse, themselves. The best solution is to go for assistance, and they stare at the map, seeing how it is possible. They are doubtful they can paddle 27 miles in a day, but are hopeful that they can get close enough to make the damned phone operational so they can get word back to base camp. In the early morning, Tim and Sean will cross back over the portage and make one last check for Dan, providing he doesn't find them tonight. The scouts have started a fire in the camp's pit. There is plenty of wood. As the long evening stretches into darkness, Jerry Wills instructs them to hang lanterns in the trees near the shore. They will stay up later than usual tonight, tending the fire, keeping it well lit. The campfire and lanterns will serve as reasonable beacons in the dark, should Dan Stevens make it to the opposite shore. Near the close of day, Dan Stevens stumbles along the edge of the old beaver pond. He is tired. He's not thinking clearly. This deep in boggy woods, the bugs are swarming. He locates a dead spruce, breaks off enough branches to make a crude but snug lean-to. He pulls up 3-foot-high swamp grass and bundles it tightly enough to line his shelter. He knows he needs to cover himself. It is getting cold. A mosaic of tiny lacerations make his bare legs ache. He watches the bugs swarm over his arms and face. He fights them off, rubbing his body, brushing the insane clouds from his scratched and broken skin. His reasoning is still muddled and unfocused. Of one thing he is sure. He is about as uncomfortable as he can ever remember being. Darkness is coming. He considers the oncoming cold abstractly, as though it is something outside him. He is close to water, and coherent enough to know it is essential. He kneels in the high grass at the beaver pond to take one last drink, and an insect swarm rises. Something about the way it comes over him in the dusky light by the pond falls on him like a pile of rocks. A dull anger rises in his throat, and a scream throttles out of him. It is a long, piercing wail, practically inhuman. It is a call to obliterate all pestilence and malaise. It is a plaintive lamentation for solace, and it is answered by an intensified ache in his head. The insect whir pauses, startled by the cry. His anger doesn't subside, but he restrains himself enough to prevent another wailing scream. And then the whir recovers, and the dark cloud threatens him anew. Almost a mile away, the scouts are gathered around the campfire. The entire group is quiet in the growing dark, happy to have the fire to tend, to give them purpose and comfort. In the west, the long northern dusk hangs above the trees. The still water reflects the opposite shore and the fading crimson light. The scouts are quiet for a moment, gathered around the campfire. And then out of the southern dark they hear a cry. It is far away and faint, but clear. Blood-curdling are the words that come to Tim Jones, though he doesn't utter them. Before he can look up to see if others have heard, one of the younger boys asks, "Did you hear that?" The boy's face is pinched and incredulous in the firelight. He looks like he has heard a phantom. Jerry Wills raises a hand to silence everyone, and they listen in the dark for several mute seconds.
God, Jerry Wills mutters, before he can catch himself.
My God.
What was that?
Another scout finally asks. There is no way to know. It could be Dan's voice, or maybe something inhuman, or maybe entirely too human, filled with misery and anguish. Jerry Wills thinks that if it is Dan, a bear may have finished the work it started earlier. But he doesn't voice his suspicions. Instead, he gets up and turns to the dark eastern shore.
Dan!
He yells, screaming into the night. His voice echoes back empty against the trees on the opposite shore. The others pause after Jerry Wills' call. They stop to listen for a response. Then they all join him in the near dark, calling Dan's name, blowing their whistles. Their efforts are frenetic and hopeful, as though one last chance has been offered at the close of a very long day. Tim Jones finally makes them stop. They pause, listening in the dark. Some of them have blown so hard their breathing is labored in the flickering light. The only other sound is the flames, eating their way through heavy pine boughs.
I hope that wasn't him, one of the younger scouts says.
They all feel heavy in the day's last light. They crowd a little closer around the flames. They all wish for the same thing, that it wasn't their guide who cried out. They don't want to contemplate alternatives, either the depth of Stevens's pain or the being out of which a cry like that arose.
Maybe a cougar,
Jerry Wills finally suggests, though he doesn't believe it. I've heard a cougar's caterwaul can sound like a man's scream. Maybe a wolf, Tim Jones adds. None of the scouts quarrel with their leaders, but no one believes them. After a while, Dan Stevens has calmed himself enough to turn back down to his hovel. He has heard nothing in the dark. He is hunkered down near the beaver pond, at a low point in the landscape. He still has a headache, and there's a mild ringing in his ears. He can hear the swarm. He can hear the dull, seething mass of bugs fighting to feed on him. On the way to his lean-to, he sees a long pine bole, perfect for a walking stick. It is at least something he can use to defend himself, should a raccoon, moose, or bear come foraging in the night. He reaches down, picks it up in the dusky light. He breaks off the branches and snaps the top. He weighs it in his hands, then drops the narrow part to the ground. The thicker end fits the grip of his hand. He lays it beside his shelter, with an easy grasp. He's careful to note the last rim of light on the western world, a dull blip of illumination with enough in its center to identify west. He lays the stick in a due east-west position. He'll use it in the morning to double-check his position. He turns to crawl back into the grass, to lie down in darkness and the oncoming cold, and wrap himself in the crude bundles of swamp rushes. Gradually, the evening fills in with the muted whir of the forest night. Jerry Wills hopes he was mistaken about the bear. Contemplation of the cry makes his skin rise in bumps across the back of his neck and down his arms. He tells himself he was mistaken, that the dark woods are playing tricks, that maybe it was a cougar's caterwaul or a wolf's howl. He and Tim tried to put the best face on the cry, their predicament, their angry interchange of words that earlier in the evening flashed like kerosene out of the dark, leaving them both a little raw. The night stretches before them. For the first time, both men long for their own beds, where their wives would nestle close, and their mattresses would assuage back and shoulder pain better than this hard northern ground. Even the scouts worry about the long, dark night of little sleep and troubled dreams, though they finally know they have to turn in. As the blackness settles, Dan Stevens tries to sleep, but the bugs give new meaning to pestilence and swarm. 7. Deeper into woods. Near Amu Creek, north of the Powwow Trail. Tuesday morning, October 23, 2001. Sometime in the middle of the night, rain starts ticking Jason's tent fly. He had been dreaming, though he cannot recall the details. He lies in the darkened tent, listening to the raindrops gathering strength. The wind increases. He feels warm and secure in his mummy bag. From somewhere, perhaps carried by the wind, he feels a rising vague concern. Before he can identify the source of his uneasiness, he rolls over, closes his eyes, and drifts back into a pleasant torpor. He awakens after daybreak, such as